Produced by PI Media.
Hi and welcome to CP Radio, the Checkpoint Research Podcast. I'm Ran Levy. Have you ever experienced a really bad fall? Down a flight of stairs, off a bike, onto a hard surface? It sucks, of course, but luckily, your body subconsciously protected you. In even a split second, too little time to process a full thought, your brain tells your arms to extend out or your legs to help cradle the impact. It's something that's biologically built into us because we can survive an injury to an arm, a foot, or a knee, but a head, a spine, that'll put you out for good. Some body parts are simply more vital to function and more sensitive to damage than others. The internet is built of all kinds of machines, connections, and protocols. You can create a virus that wipes out millions of computers around the world, and the internet itself will continue to work perfectly fine. You could even snip one of the transcontinental underwater communications cables that connect entire hemispheres to one another, and there are enough others to go around that most people will experience only moderate slowdowns. But there are other body parts that are particularly vital and particularly sensitive.
DNS is one of the building blocks of the internet, I would say.
You're listening to Yaniv Balmas, head of cyber research at Checkpoint. DNS is short for Domain Name System.
So the internet works with IP addresses. When you browse to Google, you browse to an IP address. That's the way routing works in the internet. But this routing is meant for computers, not for human beings. And for us, unfortunately, it's pretty hard to remember this set of numbers, 192.80 point whatever. So here's where DNS comes in. Basically, DNS lets us translate these IP addresses into more human-readable names, let's say. So when I ask my browser to browse to google.com, what happens behind the scenes is that my browser uses DNS in order to connect to the DNS server and tell him, hey, DNS server, this guy just asked me to browse to google.com. What's the IP address of that server? And the DNS server will respond with an IP address, and then routing can happen, and I can happily browse to Google, basically.
DNS is basically the phone book or the Google Maps of the internet. Without it, data wouldn't know where to go.
It's the backbone of the internet. So if you find a vulnerability in the backbone of the internet, practically, you can break the internet, and that's going to be interesting, and that's going to be devastating. And that's what made us look at DNS.
There are two major implementations of DNS, two widely used phone books.
There's Bind and there's MSDNS.
Bind, short for Berkeley Internet Name Domain, is a completely open source DNS protocol based in Linux. MSDNS, short for Microsoft DNS, is not open source. It's proprietary code, closely guarded by Microsoft.
The first decision will be to choose which one of them are you're going to look at, because each one of them is a complete world of its own. Our thoughts were, open source has been reviewed to the death. I mean, there is like bazillion security researchers who already looked at that. What are our chances now to find something there? So it might be a better choice to go for the MSDNS, because MSDNS is the complete opposite of that. It's closed source. It's developed by Microsoft. Nobody knows the source code, but everybody uses it, at least everybody who uses Microsoft. For us, at least, it felt like MSDNS has more potential to find vulnerabilities.
How do you guys get to the source code if it's not open source?
Well, the easy answer to that is that we don't. There is no source code. There is source code, but it's very closely guarded by Microsoft. We don't have it. but we do have the implementation itself. I mean, at the end of the day, something on our Windows machine or Windows server is running this code. It's binary code, but one of the tools in every, at least good researcher's bag of tricks is reverse engineering abilities. And reverse engineering means exactly this. You take a binary, something that's not readable by humans, and you kind of transform it into something that is readable.
The way Yaniv describes it doesn't quite do justice to just how taxing this stage of the operation is. More often than not, the binary file being reversed lacks many of the small details that make code more readable for humans. Things like comments, variable, and function names. Compilers strive to optimize the code to make it run as fast and efficiently as possible. And in the process, parts of the original code, functions, loops, classes, and the like, are transformed to other more efficient structures or removed completely. The result is that to anyone not trained in doing so, reverse engineering is practically impossible. Even for analysts thoroughly experienced in doing so, it takes excruciatingly long.
At least in this case, we're talking about at least a few weeks.
After diligently parsing the binary code, the team now had to decide what to do with what they've uncovered.
Where do you look for inside this, you know, jungle of code? Where do you look for vulnerabilities? So that, again, is kind of an expertise. An experienced researcher develops kind of a smell for these things.
Using only their noses, the researchers began poking around the code. Ironically, anything that looked unimportant to the protocol was the most interesting from a security perspective.
Usually the places that you have more chances to find vulnerabilities will not be the straightforward places. I mean, because those places are, you know, probably reviewed by Microsoft, and it makes much more sense to follow the path less taken, let's say. So where, you know, those niche places inside the protocol, those kind of functionalities that are just very rarely used but are still part of the implementation, that will be a much better place to look for vulnerabilities. So that's our initial hunch, and that's where we go.
The researchers began looking down every obscure, dark road they could find.
We go and try to map these places. Okay, where do we have these places, these strange functionalities, these, you know, things that are used once in a million years? Let's try to focus on them.
After some extensive searching, Yaniv and his colleagues discovered a tiny dirt road out in the middle of nowhere. The kind of road that doesn't even make it onto most maps because it hasn't been used in years.
So in DNS, you can send many, many different type of requests. The most common one will be what we just discussed, you know, and it's called an A query. But there are many other DNS request that exists. Specifically, the DNS request that we looked at is called a SIG request. Now, what is a SIG request? You know, initially when we found it, I actually didn't have an idea what's a SIG request.
When a team of security researchers with over 100 years of experience between them doesn't recognize the kind of code, you know you've got something good.
Later, we found out that it has something to do with, actually, it's pretty amusing because it's part of something called DNSSEC, which is like an addition to DNS, which is supposed to make it more secure. But so it's funny that we found a vulnerability in the place that should make DNS more secure. Basically what it is, it's a simple buffer override.
Buffer override, also known as buffer overflow. A common but powerful exploit. One of the fundamental pillars of computer security is the notion of memory safety. That is, each software running on a machine has its own allocated memory region, and it can't read or write from a memory region allocated to a different software. Why? Well, imagine the following scenario. You open your favorite media player, select a movie, and press play. you wish to watch the movie. But the CPU, being a machine, has no idea what a movie is. All it knows is that when the user clicks the play button, the media player software instructs it to go to a particular memory location, read its contents, and execute whatever code it finds there. Now, imagine if some malicious software was able to modify that memory location's content and replace the code that displays the movie with code that instructs the CPU to format the hard drive. The CPU, being unaware that anything is out of the ordinary, would execute that malicious code, wiping your hard drive clean. That's basically why we have memory safety.
You know, computers are pretty stupid. So when they need to get an input, so they assign a buffer, and this buffer has a certain size. So let's say this buffer is 10 bytes long, something like that, right? Now, if you have a 10 bytes long buffer, then you can store data that is of size 10 bytes inside that, right? That makes sense. But unfortunately, programmers, they introduce bugs sometimes. And one such bug can be that, you know, the guy who wrote this code forgot to check the size that's going to be inserted into this buffer. So let's say that I, as a user, inserted 20 bytes long buffer, and he forgot to check. So what will happen is that he will insert 20 bytes into a buffer of size 10.
Those extra 10 bytes that overflowed from the buffer can, quote-unquote, spill over to a memory region allocated to some other software running on the same machine, in essence, circumventing the memory safety mechanism. That's what makes buffer overflow bugs so dangerous.
What it means, basically, is that you can use this thing in order to run your own code on the server, code that was not meant to run there in the first place, and something that you know, whatever you provide can run on the server.
Basically, with this SIG vulnerability, an attacker could do whatever they want with any machine running MS-DNS.
I can run whatever I want on the DNS server, and in my terms at least, this is completely equivalent to a full network compromise, because from this DNS server, I can practically do whatever I want with your entire network. I will now have credentials to go anywhere, to go into any computer, to do anything I want. All I had to do for that is to send you a simple, quote-unquote, DNS request.
And the kicker? It's completely invisible to the victim. They have no clue what's going on.
That's the beauty of exploits.
The CPR team gave their discovery a name, SIGRED.
I'm not sure if I should brag about this. I'm not really happy about this, but Microsoft, so vulnerabilities get scores. It's like the Olympics of vulnerabilities. You get a score, and we're not in a race with anyone, of course, but SIGRED, this specific vulnerability, got a 10.0 score. So 10 out of 10 in terms of severity. You know, there are very few vulnerabilities with this score being published any year, maybe two or three of them.
One of the trickiest part of being a security researcher has nothing to do with reading code or uncovering vulnerabilities. It's handling the information you have in a responsible manner. When the CPR team developed a 10 out of 10 exploit in the backbone of the internet, it was a bit like finding a bomb on a train. You can't just get rid of it right then and there. You need the explosive experts. But if word gets out to anyone besides them, chaos will ensue. Passengers will start freaking out, and the attacker will probably get word of it. So they'll set off the bomb before you have time to defuse it.
We contact Microsoft and tell them about this bug. We don't run and publish that and shout it, you know, out loud, but we wait for a certain time. Usually this is 90 days that we, you know, gracefully give Microsoft in order to create a patch and deploy it to everyone. In this specific case, since this vulnerability was so severe, we waited even more than 90 days.
After over 3 months, Microsoft developed and deployed a SIGRED patch, and CPR published their findings online. And this should be where our story ends. But unfortunately, it's where an even worse story begins.
So the thing that comes to mind now is, presumably there's now a patch for this hole. But whenever Windows releases a patch, everybody still has to download it. So is it possible that some, if not a significant portion of DNS servers out in the world are still vulnerable to this?
That's a very interesting and I think a very important question.
When Microsoft releases a software patch, it doesn't automatically, magically fix the world's computers. Users have to actually download the patch to go to their settings, click the button, maybe restart the system. But not everybody does that. Your grandmother isn't savvy enough to know how to. But even people who know the importance of updating often aren't in a position to do so.
Patching or deploying security patches is a long process for, especially for big organizations.
Imagine you run a big company, or better yet, a major piece of critical infrastructure like an electrical grid. Your machinery runs on Windows, so when a new update comes out, you'll want to download it and make sure everything is secure. But you can't just reboot the software running an electrical plant. Power is something that everybody needs constantly. Are you going to take a megaphone and announce to the nearest city, "Hey guys, we've got an important update to Windows we've got to download, so just hang on and don't watch TV for like 20 minutes. Nah, no way.
It's not something that you can just trivially do, especially not on such an important server like the DNS server in your organization. So at the time we actually published this vulnerability, the patch was already out there and deployed to many machines. Is it all the machines out there? No. The answer is no.
At large organizations and some of the most important sites in the whole world, the SIGRED vulnerability is probably still waiting, out there in the open. And you can bet there are people who are interested in, let's say, playing around with it.
The NSA just published, like, I think it was a week ago, they published a list of 25 vulnerabilities that are being either scanned for or used by China. It's part of their, they kind of released some of their intelligence. And what do you know, SIGRED was one of them.
The worst part about SIGRED is that it's out of our hands now. Even Microsoft and CPR can only wait and hope. So although this podcast is now coming to a close, the story of SIGRED may have more chapters yet to come. That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. For past episodes, visit Checkpoint's research blog at research.checkpoint.com, and you can follow Checkpoint Research on Twitter or follow me at @ranlevy. That's R-A-N-L-E-V-I. CP Radio is produced by PI Media, written by Nate Nelson, produced by Guy B. Noon, and edited and narrated by me, Ran Levy. See you next episode. Bye-bye.